Thanks a million for having me down here. I'm a little bit of a cold, so hopefully I won't be coughing or sputtering too much later. I'm going to start off with my only sonnet. It's called Romance. Romance. Sitting on the fridges in short sweet shop is what we did in those days. Smoking single ciggies for all we were worth, a twopence halfpenny apiece. And when the handsome savvy boy told me the truth about stitches and caesarean sections, I knew it was over between us. The bank debt and IMF are in the news again. This next poem is it's set on the first visit. It's called Bailout Day. And it's sort of an homage to the great Frank O'Hara, and it borrows very heavily from his poem, Khrushchev is Coming. Bailout Day, after Frank O'Hara. Chopra is coming on the right day. Next door is Kat mooching for cheese. Flicks the fractals of crystals from her paw, and everything is freezing. I'm running for the door. This country has everything but Polish, the cab driver from Cabra says. And when I text Martha, she texts me that he couldn't make this shit up. And he tells me that Band de Valera grew up on this road, along with the pair who sang the national anthem to end the night in the GPO. Maybe it's better than Cher, Mary says. That's what she thinks. Voting's rigged. And Chopra was probably being loved up in Kildare Street. No Polish. So I'd love to be home in bed when I'm driving or being driven past Heaney Avenue, Kavanagh Avenue, and on to Beckett Way. All unknown figures of the early morning as I go to work. As the plane bears Chopra out of Dublin Airport, an email from Warsaw announces the arrival of all 4.13 kilograms, 57 centimeters, of Patrick Nievchek, whose name means never on time, and the light seems filled with silence and joy stamped through with footprints. I'm foolish enough always to find it in snow. A lot of the collection is concerned with memory and maybe that it's not exactly an exact science. The next poem we're going to read is called Forgetting, and it features the Greek goddess. In the Mausoleum. It's got an epigraph from Francis Bacon. It says, "There is no excellent beauty that hath not some strangeness in proportion." Mnemosyne, I have forgotten how much I dislike Greek myth and poetry, how much I miss the amused face and the mask of little Thalia, how disconcerting it is to look at you in a painting by Dante Gabriel Rossetti, your pre-Raphaelite lips, your androgynous body. Continuing on with the memory theme is a short sequence of poems that have titles that are that correspond to memory disorders, and the first three are sort of nuances on the déjà vu theme, and the last one is a sort of the opposite of déjà vu. So start with déjà vu. You cry as you listen to the man on the radio, how he describes his life as a tedium of future memory, where nothing is new. Always the same dark bird sings in the same vexed tree, the song that he listens to. Deja visite. Your thoughts are of love, as incense in the old cathedral, coiling the breath of warm vermilion, dissipating everywhere. Deja senti. Your eyes are closed, still you feel you know the place. It is sinewy here, mossy soft there, wet, the texture of wayward synapses hitting on errant nerves. Jamais vu. You write the word on the page, repeat until it is meaningless, liberated, The next poem I'm going to read is, I have access to my great-grandfather's diaries. I have a genealogist in the family who's preserved them, and this poem is it's almost a found poem. It doesn't stray too far from the diary. It's from 1889, and we're kind of, you know, it's not too long after the famine, and we tend to think of that time as being sort of staged and sort of sepia toned, but well, his reality seems to be quite a bit different. Martin's diary, 1889. On July 27th, he met Hewitt and the two Miss Kites, got very great with Miss Flynn, and went for a walk. By August 4th, it was the Mrs. Butler, Ryan, and Purdon, the former the charmer with the deep blue eyes. August 5th, drinking and chatting with Matt O'Sullivan about Aristotle and the five trout caught that Friday. The 16th was a desperate night's dance where he stood a dozen porter and the women were drunk, and of course the Mrs. White and Piggott and Talbot. By the middle of September it all got out of hand, the 15th in Dunlavin with Brady and Browner and the lovely Miss Duffy dancing and drinking till dawn. And it was the gentle hints of this transaction later that led to his resolution, taken the 21st of October, to abstain from all intoxicating drink except one pint or a bottle of stout daily for 1 year, the last entry in a notebook with a cracked leather cover, stalwart stitching, and tied with a dun ribbon. Sorry, the next poem is, it was inspired after going to see Maritza, the fado, Portuguese fado singer, in the National Concert Hall, and I got tickets at the back of the stage. They're kind of odd seats, they just look down on the stage, and the fado is kind of, it's at its heart, it's got this notion of saudade, which I told is an untranslatable word. So I guess this poem is my attempt to translate it. I've included in the epigraph the Wikipedia translation, really just to try and make myself look good. This is the Wikipedia translation. Fado is a musical, cultural expression and recognition of unassailable determinism which compels the resigned yearning of saudade, a bittersweet existential yearning and hopefulness towards something over which one has no control. And I'll just continue with my translation. From the cheap seats above the stage, she is skeletal, a marionette. When her arm twists like tempered flamenco, three shadows follow, nuanced to the dark. But when she sings, time stands like a shy one at a dance, shuffling from foot to foot, not knowing what to do with the saudade in its hands. The next poem is a sort of a response from the US poet Billy Collins has a poem called Taking Off Emily Dickinson's Clothes, and in it he describes, you know, undressing Emily Dickinson. And it's kind of very cold, frigid description of this event anyway. But he obviously didn't read her letters. But this one is a response poem, or possibly a revenge poem. It's called Taking Off Billy Collins' Clothes, after he had taken off Emily Dickinson. First, the lanyard, all Oedipal and complex, for it had rubbed uncomfortably and incessantly against the nipple of my left breast. And the V-neck I raised over his slow eyes as he held up his arms with the small obedience of a polite boy. Next, the white vest, my fingers pushing through to the black hairs of his white chest. You will want to know that he was standing in the panelled room beneath the heavy clock, that there was a slight shortness in his breath as I pulled a little tighter on the belt before I loosed it. There is nothing difficult about men's undergarments in the 21st century, and I proceeded like a short order chef, searing the idioms of his nakedness. Later, I wrote about it in the notebook, for I was inclined to reveal all, how I left him then, standing beneath the black lantern in the hall, with only his loud vernacular horn, boasting of all the shy, wide-eyed women he imagined that he'd known. I just read a couple of two or three short lyrics. This is called Blackbirds. It used to be called 13 Ways of Strangling a Blackbird. It's now called Blackbird. At 4 a.m. through the velocks they sing that the body is metaphor for the being, its posture and gesture, the slack skin of its dream, a drum of teeth falling out through the mouth of a dentshow bell, the monk in the cell creaking the daily miracle of relentless resurrection and the racket it makes. Lighthouse. Remembering the bred geese, puffed chests, the ferment of their grassy bellies full, marching out to sea from the shelly banks to some Icelandic fjord, I think of their trenchant equations, how they could never stay in the landscape that I held a while in my arms, then let go, like the water that falls from trees after the rain has gone. This one's called Light Snow Carantoul. A blizzard of April snow falls upon feldspar and over the green copper spots on the face of the mountain that might be a table on which I am set, around which Magian guests conspire to change its landscape, like the quick-quick trick of the cloth that leaves the rattling cup wishing a gentle hand would just settle it somehow. This next poem is called Innocence, and it refers to the practice of hanging a pair of sneakers from a site where a drug dealing site. Innocence. Maybe it was simply a lack of serotonin in my body today that made me drive with one hand on the wheel, the other tapping myself as if I had forgotten something. When I stopped at lights, I saw a child's trainers thrown on a telephone wire, off kilter, one foot close to the line, the other dangling long by the lace, like a tilted scales on a lost stave. And it put me in mind of a barefoot child, a notion as half-formed and incongruous as the one about how it is the meek who will inherit the earth. This next poem is was inspired by a line that I read in a Guardian article talking about writer's block, which I had during the 5 words challenge there. I thought it was a great line. It says, you don't hear of accountants who can't open a spreadsheet or farmers who take against fields. And it's called Fear of the Spreadsheet. All my life I have stared at these numbers afraid. They are sacred vessels, tabernacles. The zero, its seeming innocence with its open mouth, the very spit and image of nothingness. The one that would divide me while keeping me whole. I sometimes imagine a number, and lately I have come to prod with a stick at the cell where its formula is hiding, its roots rustling, their tangled spy roots from profit and loss to balance sheet. And what I fear most in this desperate mess is this awful devotion, this commitment. The next poem makes reference to the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which I only heard about within the last year, and I just wondered how come I had never heard about it. It's like a what they call the seventh continent in the Pacific Ocean, and it's made of plastic basically. It's where all the plastic rubbish just congregates and builds this new continent, as they call it. And there's more plastic in the water than there is plankton, so the fish ingest it. So anyway, it's called James. Calm today, the bay streams its silks along its shallows, troubles the heron's shadow to shiver in a hall of mirrors, while the bird stands motionless, waiting for the minnows that have gathered in the harbour, black brush strokes like night falling on a broken skylight, water churning on its belly with the sound of the seal's swim breath, turning as if turning by wind curl or the Coriolis effect, are physical and fictitious forces, the great Pacific garbage patch, pelagic plastics, polymer roots, barbed aquatic crosshatch of the new continent of trash, the size of Texas, becalmed mid-ocean, in these latitudes for working off a dead horse debt, photodegradation in the ocean, disintegration to ever smaller pieces, to a polymer, to a molecule, to flotsam in the food chain. Split open your average albatross stomach and what do you find? You find spilt ocean zooplankton, a few invertebrates, the occasional fish, but more, much more than this, mistaken by the endocrine system, endo meaning inside, crinus secrete, mistaken, that is to say fooled, into hormone disruption which affects our mood, our bottle tops, lighters, and fishing lures. The next poem is about language, I guess, and in particular sort of the redemptive power of language. It's called From the Irish. Before the days of golden stars, in a room grey as a prophecy, the woman wore her widow's weeds, laced with a black-bordered aura. He knew that she held more harm in ghosts in the dark or any sly crack in a path. So when she took him for Irish, taught him the hard way, nouns for the pictures she'd drawn, a house with no windows, a hog with a curl in its tail. He took to the language precisely like a heron inherits the air, and wherever the cane came down, all that came out from his mother-tongue mouth was muck. I'll finish with this one. It's called Dinner with Old Friends and the Summer Solstice. At the last reading with the Russian gypsy cards, they predicted my heart would be ignited by love. Now, as a host clears the dinner things, I lay down the cards again, anchors and knotted ropes. I could tell them that when I woke this morning, I couldn't remember what year it was. I could tell them that our grief is our own. I could tell them, but it's late, and they'd only tell me to get over myself. So slowly I turn away from these things and tilt my head toward the light, like the earth on the longest day, like love on the shortest night. Thanks very much.